This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz. This program is sponsored by New Zealand Bridge, sponsors of Grassroots Bridge across the nation.
Welcome to the Bridge Zone. You're at the table with Barry and Mariana. We are at Congress and don't really want to say, but it's still cold in the arena. I've got my little woolly jacket. I'm all prepared and a lot of people are prepared. So well done, everybody.
Maybe it's the time of year.
Barry's got the New Zealand Open final and I will give you the report on the restricted pairs final.
Well, the New Zealand Open was quite exciting. Liam Milne and James Cooch were leading by 100 match points at one part of it. And it was starting to look like a walk in the park. It didn't stay like that. And with one round to go, Michael Cornell and Ashley Bark, who won it last year, were only 4 match points behind. Anyway, James and Liam did manage to hang on and they actually ended up winning by about 17 match points from Michael Cornell and Ashley Bark, with Peter Newell and Martin Reid about 50 match points behind that. Exciting stuff.
And in the restricted pairs final, that was taken out by the people that won at Howick. So Anne and Leo Sim won the restricted pairs final, and Lysandra Zing and Tim Pan second, with Raymond and Jack Quinnell third. Congratulations, they're having a great run.
Open pairs plate, some interesting winners. Daniela von Arnhem, who used to play with Sabine Hawkins, so she's won some pretty big international events. She's over here this year. She was playing with Geiske Joel, and they won the plate by a long way, by about 89 match points. From Hamilton members, Jeffrey Chang and Yuzhong Chen.
Well, since you did the plate, I'm going to do the plate for the restricted pairs. The winners were Bev Hurst and Charmaine Hanbury-Webber, and Casey Lee and Biggie Cameron was second.
In the intermediate people, so Monica Cheng and Joy Zing won that, from Tash London and Karen Palmer-Hall.
Mm.
So the teams already start tomorrow, quite a big field in the open teams.
Yeah, and then after that, after coming out of that washing machine, we go back to restricted open.
Okay, it'll be fun playing in the open teams. Who knows who you'll get to meet?
The Gin Club starts their improver sessions. We've got Malcolm Mayer up first tomorrow, 9 a.m.
What's he talking about?
Oh, look, do you really want me to say? No, I'll tell you what it is. No, like I said, I don't really want to say. His subject is Trump management.
Okay. He probably needs a bit of that, Mr. Trump.
Trump management. And on Wednesday, Richard Solomon is taking the topic on Catch Them If You Can, Double Trouble. And Thursday, Alan Grant has the floor with safety plays. So if you're around, it starts at 9 o'clock. It is free, normally lasts about 40 minutes, and play starts at 10 o'clock.
Okay, and they're usually pretty well attended, these events.
Yeah, they seem to run out of room most of the time. So you had a catch-up with your mixed teams that are heading off to Argentina?
We had dinner tonight, yes, we did. That was nice. Went to an Italian restaurant.
Was it good?
The food was very good. It was a long time coming. So I won't name the restaurant, but when it arrived, it was very good. I did say to Mariana, she texted me and said, can we do the Bridge Zone? And I said, we're having dinner, but we won't be late. Well, that was a silly thing to say. Hours went past.
Actually, looking around yesterday, so Sunday, I got the feeling that there weren't as many people playing over the weekend than there was last year. Did you get that feeling?
I'm not as observant as that. Look, I can't find something in the pantry. What chances are there me looking around the room and knowing how many people there are there? Richard did say the numbers were similar, and they reckon there's about 600 people playing, so it's sort of similar to last year. But whether those numbers were as big on this weekend, not sure about that.
I think the teams events are going to be very popular. People do like to play teams, so I expect that the room is going to be quite full tomorrow. Have you had an ice cream yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should have an ice cream at lunchtime, Barry.
you buy them at the venue, do you?
Yeah.
It's been nice to catch up with a lot of people that I haven't seen for a year.
Have you met the players that came over from Shanghai yet? Did you come across them?
I don't believe they played the pairs.
Ah.
So they're just coming for the teams. They're going to hit us with everything in the teams.
I went to the AGM at Mount Maunganui on Friday afternoon, and Murray said that they had to rejig the draw because an international pair didn't enter in the open, so they redid the draw. I'm not too sure which country. He didn't say which country.
Well, we're recording this at nearly 10 o'clock on Monday night, and the teams start tomorrow. I still haven't seen a draw, but it must exist.
The other thing I'm just saying about the AGM, it was rather quick. It seemed okay. There wasn't anything really pressing about it. We did adopt their new constitution. One of the things about the constitution on the NZB is that they don't need a quorum to conduct their AGM because they don't actually have individuals like the clubs do. So that was unusual. And then I also piped up about the online tournaments, you know, like people were given weekends in the tournament calendar, and I was asking what was going to happen, and they didn't really disclose what was happening, but they said there would be communication coming out to all the clubs about the online facilities after Congress. You're still entitled to host a tournament online during the week, but just not on the weekends. And they are mindful about the clash of face-to-face and everything. And I did speak about, you know, just having the opportunity to apply when we were told that no, we weren't. And I did say that the communication was that not too many clubs were putting in a request to change. And I did mention that we actually said that we couldn't. It was going to be tough cookie if you did apply. So we're getting some direction after to Congress. Now, you've normally pretty good with your gut feelings on what's going to happen. You keep your nose and your ears to the ground. What's the goss, Barry?
I don't know any goss, but I mean, when they start talking about, they're going to talk about the future of online bridge, I don't know. I think there's some people that really don't like online bridge, and maybe it's not looking too bright.
We've got a wee bit of time left over this week because we're at Congress. I came across this video that Peter Hollins did, and as I listened to it, I thought, wow. What he's going to talk about is the hand that changed bridge scoring forever. Now, if you ever wonder why you went for 500, 800 instead of the simple 50 and 100, here is the backbone for it. So we're going to play the majority of the clip this week, and we'll finish off with the rest of it next week. And by the way, it does work because I've seen two minus 1100s come back to the scoring table today. Enjoy.
G'day, it's Pete here, and today we're going to dive into one of the most memorable moments in bridge history. It's a single hand that not only helped swing the 1981 Bermuda Bowl final, but also helped change the scoring rules forever. If you've ever wondered why you go for 800 so much, this is part of the reason why. All right, so it's 1981. It's the Bermuda Bowl Finals, the World Championship of Bridge. This is the highest level that you can actually get to. Pakistan is facing off against USA in one of the most intense bridge battles there's been. There were some major events that came out of this world championship. For instance, Bobby Levin became the youngest ever bridge world champion at just 23 years old. This was a record that stood for 34 years. Also, Zia Mahmood led Pakistan to their first ever silver medal in a world championship. This was, I believe, their first time even in the Bermuda Bowl. They were expected maybe to come last, but they had a sensational event and made it all the way to the finals. This is a moment that helped cement Zia Mahmood as one of the legends of our game and put him in bridge history forever. But while these may be the milestones that people remember this Bermuda Bowl for, there is one hand in particular that stands out. And that's a hand that shook the bridge world and caused the rules to change forever. And that hand belongs to Jeff Mextroth. So let's take a look at this hand. So at the first table, what happened here was Solidar opened two clubs strong. Zia came in and bid two diamonds, and Arnold here bid two spades, which showed an ace and a king. Here, West raised diamonds with just two, and Solidar bid four clubs natural, Four hearts natural. Four spades here was meant as a Cupid. It kind of looks a little bit ambiguous, but they still managed to persevere through it. Five diamonds was a Cupid. He agreed that hearts were trumps, and Arnold raised to six hearts. And at this stage, Solidar realized that partner doesn't actually have any clubs, so we can trump those out. And if he's got the ace of diamonds and king jack to five hearts, there aren't any losers on this hand. So he bid seven hearts in a 5-2 fit. Can you even remember the last time that you bid a grand slam, let alone bidding a grand slam without eight trumps? Anyway, the play to this hand was relatively straightforward. Seven hearts was a great contract. They got the king of diamonds lead, which was won by the ace, and two rounds of trumps were drawn. Now he proceeded to play ace of clubs, didn't cash the king of clubs, but just trumped a club high and then drew trumps. They ended up being 3-3, but if they were 4-2, that was still going to be fine. So he made seven hearts, getting a score of 22-10. Now at the other table, the auction proceeded pretty similar. So two clubs was open, but this was an ackle two in clubs. This was it showed clubs here, and South bid two hearts. They repeated clubs, and South has this awkward rebid, and they chose to repeat three hearts, which allowed Munir to raise hearts, and now Fazli was firmly in control. Asked for aces, found out that they had three. Six diamonds was asking about the queen of trumps, and they also bid seven hearts, which, when this was on ViewGraph, got a round of applause. The 5-2 fit being bid to grand slam at both tables. But while all that was happening, Jeff Maxroff was a little bit forgotten here. But he shouldn't have been, because he came back in with seven spades on this hand. Five spades to the jack. Could you imagine not bidding at all, neither you or your partner, all the way till the opponents get to grand slam, and now you come in with this five spades to the jack? So for here, Jeff Maxroth saw an opportunity. He had five spades to the jack. He had a weak hand. Most players would just pass here. But what he knew is that if he sacrificed in spades, and even if he went down heavily, he could still earn points, because if he went down 11 tricks, that would have only scored minus 2,100. And he decided to make one of the gutsiest bids in bridge history and bid seven spades. In Jeff's own words, he said, "I've never been more nervous making a bid in my life. In 1981, in the Bermuda Bowl Finals, I had Jack 5 in spades at favorable vulnerability. They'd rolled into seven hearts, but when it came round to me, I computed that down 11 is minus 2,100. I thought that I could do better, and after a long huddle, I bid seven spades." So how did seven spades go? So here in the play, the ace of clubs was led, and then king of clubs was continued, and then they switched to ace of hearts and another heart, which got overtaken. And now the jack of hearts got played, and Munir threw the nine of diamonds, which opened up a possibility for the defense to go slightly awry. They could have actually, the best defense here is to cash the ace king of spades. But when he pitched the nine of diamonds, what this allowed was it allowed them to try and get a diamond rough, but this was with a natural trump trick. So it went ace of diamonds, and they roughed a diamond, and now you can't draw both of dummy's trumps. So when it went ace of spades, now when it went a club, they roughed in with the ten of spades, and here South gets the queen of spades, but no more. And they get out for down nine. And this was minus 1,700, which meant that the USA picked up 11 imps. And this was the first hand that gave the Americans the lead in the Bermuda Bowl final. Up till then, Pakistan had been leading.
And you'll be able to hear how that event affected scoring at the bridge table in the future next week.
Coming up next, we're heading off to the courthouse. Director, please.
How can I help?
Judge Julie presiding.
It's Congress week and we're still with Judge Julie. G'day.
Hi, and congratulations to everyone that's done well or doing well or
whatever time frame I'm in here.
So Julie and Patrick have just arrived, fresh as a daisy, ready for the teams tomorrow. So that's good. So a couple of things have happened already at Congress, which are sort of interesting director calls. One was where somebody was wanting to look at the opponent's system card when it wasn't their turn to bid. So this is a little bit like, I guess, asking a question of when it's not their turn to bid. What's the story with the system card?
Okay, you're allowed to refer to your opponent's system card when it is your turn to bid or play. Now, commonly people do sort of refer to it. You sit down, the system card's there. You read it to see what your opponents are doing. So generally not an issue, but every now and then it can convey information that you are interested in the meaning of a bid and give your partner information they shouldn't get. So if people are referring to anything when they shouldn't be, then you can call the director to the table and you will get a ruling from the director.
So the system card's only allowed to be looked at when it's your turn.
Yes.
Can you sort of sneakily, you know?
No, you can't.
No, you can't, Barry.
Oh, okay.
Interestingly enough, I never really thought of this as being an issue. And a few years ago, I think Lorraine Stokowski was directing in New Plymouth. And it came up and somebody asked me for my opinion. And I looked at the rules and it was really clear. Right? It's similar to asking a question. When it is your turn to bid or play, you can refer to the card. Now, a lot of the time people do things that make no difference, but every now and then it becomes an issue. Whenever we get to a table, whenever we start to have a problem, for whatever reason, call the director. The director is there to assist and to help, and they will give us an answer as to what may or may not be allowed, and then we know what to do and what not to do. Sitting there and getting annoyed with people or them getting annoyed with you creates an issue that gets worse and worse as it keeps occurring. All right? So please, any issues, you call the director. That is what they are there for.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. They've got nothing else to do. Get them over there and make them work.
Look, I hear all the time that the director's busy and we need to leave them alone. But the point is that when situations start to occur, if we call the director then, it gets dealt with and it is fine. If things start to get worse and worse, at a point at the table, all of us are getting upset and it's just piling up. And when we call the director then, everyone is upset and it is a lot harder for the director and for the players to deal with.
Right, okay.
Okay, issue number two, completely unrelated, and I think this has happened maybe a couple of times this week already, where a card was hidden in dummy. So there's only 12 cards visible, and the hand starts to get played, and the side that is defending is disadvantaged in some way because there was a card hidden in dummy that they never saw. What happens there? Is everybody responsible for the dummy?
No. Years ago, I wanted to put something in the New Zealand Bridge magazine about paying a reasonable sum of money to anyone who could find in the laws for me where every player at the table is responsible for dummy. Dummy is responsible for dummy's cards going on the table correctly. It is in the clearer's best interest to make sure that they see all 13 cards. All right? Because if there is a revoke or something like that, that occurs because dummy's got a card hidden, although the penalties of the revoke law don't apply, equity does. And equity is in favour of the non-offending side. And if dummy has hidden the card, they are the offending side. So if the opponents are disadvantaged because of something that dummy has done that is incorrect, then you may well find that the declaring side is going to suffer because of what could or couldn't have happened.
I see.
Okay.
When you're defending, that's just what you really want, is to see the defending side suffer. That surely is
You can't see the defending side suffer because if they are, you're going to like it even less if you're hitting the card from them. And this is there was a wonderful article written, I think, 1972, some way back in the 70s, by Tony Forrester, a UK person, and it said about how we find people at bridge are presumed to be guilty rather than innocent. So if you could have known, not that you did know, not that you did anything deliberate, but if you could have known that what you did was going to advantage your side, you're not going to get any benefit from it.
All right? Yeah, yeah.
So you could do things that mislead. Someone could do something deliberately and it would mislead the opponents and they are not going to get it. Unfortunately for everyone else, who is absolutely pure as driven snow, if they do it, they also suffer the same penalties under the law because the director does not have to make a charge of whether they think you are doing things that are unethical or not.
Okay.
All right? And that is a really good thing.
In that example, were you present at the table? Was it?
No, I wasn't. Oh. I just heard, you know, like I say, whenever I hear about somebody suffering, I always take special notice of that.
Did you ask them, was it an untidy dummy or a tidy dummy? Did they just chuck them down all messy like you?
Yeah. The other thing about people suffering is if you don't know, if you are ever a teammate of Barry's, what he does is he leaves his cell phone with you when he goes away to the other table. I live in fear of the damn thing ringing. He's a real estate agent. It is terrifying.
Oh,
hopefully this week you will leave it turned off.
I expect you to answer it and say, look, how much were you wanting to offer?
Hey, look, okay. I've got one more question for you, Judge.
God, she's going to start charging if we do more than two.
I'm sorry. So this is what happened to me today, and I wasn't sure. So partner opens one spade, and there's an overcall of two hearts.
Yeah.
I had 10 to 12 with support for spades, so I bid three spades. And then my left-hand opponent asked what the bid was, and he said it's preemptive, so 0 to 6 with lots of spades. Anyway, they bid to four hearts and then he bid four spades, passed by me and five hearts by my left-hand opponent. Now, given the information that he gave, we actually weren't the declarer side. We were now defending.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And I really wanted to double it, but I felt that I couldn't double it.
Okay, so if he had described your bid correctly, and this is what you have to do, all right? You have to pretend you did not hear the misinformation. You have to pretend your partner has described the bid as to what you thought it was.
Right.
All right?
Okay.
So in this auction, your partner has described your bid as 10 to 12, inviting game.
No. He described it as preemptive.
No, what he described it as.
I see.
But if he had described it as what you had, 10 to 12, inviting game.
Mm-hmm.
Your opponents bid four hearts, he bids four spades, they bid five hearts. What would you have done?
I would have doubled.
Well, in that case, you should.
Oh, so I'm allowed to?
It's the information that you get that you're not allowed, right? You have 10 to 12. You don't know what partner's bidding on. What he's got will be different to what it might be for the bid. Yep. But you would always have doubled when they bid five hearts. You should double now. And if they're making it doubled, then you have to wear that.
Yeah, okay. Or I thought that I ethically shouldn't double, so I passed.
Yeah. So if your partner described it as 10 to 12,
yep,
and then he doubled and you had 0 to 6, then you would have a big problem ethically.
I see. Okay.
Okay? Because you wouldn't have what he expected.
Right. Okay.
So if you think that you didn't hear what he said, he was at one end of the room, you were at the other, or behind screens, which is the other way, right? If you would have doubled five hearts when he described it correctly, then that is what you should be doing now.
Okay.
Phew. You're not allowed to hear the wrong explanation. You are only allowed to hear the explanation that you think it is.
Ah, I see.
Okay. Oh, well. For right or for wrong.
The problem comes, though, doesn't it, when if they had have had the correct explanation, they might not have ever bid five hearts.
Yeah, well, that's another issue when we get round to it.
Okay,
as to what the correct explanation by system is something that we will then get into discussion with when we are sorting out it out after the director's been called.
I see. It was a mess.
It's always a mess. Believe me, it's always a mess. Okay.
Thank you, Judge Julie.
All the best for the teams, eh?
We'll see what else we can come up with during the week for next week's show.
And I hope everyone has a good week, Mariana. And not often that I wish Barry has a good week, but I am hoping so this year. So there we go.
Should be good. All right. Thank you, Judgy.
Bye.
And we're heading into Barry's tip. Let's see what he's pulled out of his hat.
Okay. We're on to the teams coming up. So you'll be playing relatively long matches, like 10 boards.
Yeah.
And the tip is, and I've got to confess, this has actually come from Patrick, so it isn't mine, but
go, Baylor! Woo!
And the tip is that you should concentrate on the first board and concentrate on the last board, because they're the two that you're most likely to lose concentration on. So I guess he's saying that there's a lot of imps lost on the first board and the last board due to lack of concentrations. So concentrate on those two. Well, I guess you've got to concentrate on the eight in between, but it sounds like the first board and the last board are dangerous.
Right. You've got to concentrate even more. I'll take a survey and I'll make it and I'll see whether my focus wanes. And it probably does. Yeah. I tell you what, I was getting very sick of passing.
It can't be waning on the very first board. It's just that you haven't actually got into the swing of it.
Yeah, true. But, you know, when you're sick of passing because you get no cards and you get sick of doing it, and it did happen quite a few times after quite a few boards today, and you finally get something, just take a breath. Don't rush in all happy. Stay in tempo.
Yeah, but you've only been playing pairs. It's not real bridge.
Oh, you reckon? Holy.
We're going to go 2-for-1. Julie's got a good tip.
So when you're deciding whether or not to win a trick, count how many you've got and how many you need to either make your contract or to defeat the opponent's contract before you play the card.
Ooh.
It is surprising how many people make a mistake that allows their opponents to make because they simply haven't counted the number of tricks they've got.
That sounds great. Okay, well, I think we need to go and get some sleep. Thanks. See you later. Have a good time at the tables.
New Zealand Bridge, sponsoring bridge from beginner to international nationwide.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.